From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. The Justice Department wants James Risen to reveal his source for a story of bungled espionage. Risen says, forget it.
I'm going to keep fighting this, and I'll go to jail if I have to.
On this week's podcast, a First Amendment showdown. Then, who's in charge of protecting your personal information online?
I think that would actually be shocking to a lot of people that all of this information they turn over isn't required to be protected by the company.
And British-Iranian actor Omid Jalili explains how his heritage prepared him for a career in comedy.
I actually became a kind of Arab scumbag specialist.
That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. As a country, we love to shop online. Such convenience, such great deals. Still, there is a downside.
Federal officials trying to stop a major hacking attack from happening.
The prying eyes of a hacker are to blame for a
names, emails, addresses, and passwords have been compromised.
24 million people at risk for identity theft. Keep your data safe and secure in 60 seconds.
Of course, there are laws to make sure companies protect your sensitive data. Well, actually, no.
There is no one law in the United States that mandates that websites and phone applications have good data security.
That's our cover story today. Who is the sheriff of Cybertown? There is no one law to make sure your data are protected in cyberspace. Even the question of who should be protecting the consumer is up for debate. The Federal Trade Commission, under its authority to protect consumers, has stepped in to fill the void in police data security. Since the early 2000s, the FTC has brought close to 50 cases against companies with lax data security practices that they say have put consumers at risk. But now, one of those companies, Wyndham Worldwide Corporation, is fighting back, basically telling the FTC, sorry, you're not the boss of us. Jessica Rich is the director of the FTC's Bureau of Consumer Protection.
We allege that Wyndham's unreasonable data security practices permitted hackers to access its network on three separate occasions over the course of 2 years.
Wyndham Worldwide Corporation is challenging the FTC's authority to bring complaints against companies in the first place. Here's what happened. Computer servers at the hotel chain were hacked. The hackers exported credit card information from hundreds of thousands of consumers to a Russian domain. The result? Close to $11 million in fraudulent charges. Rich claims there were simple steps that could have been taken to prevent the damage.
Just some examples. Wyndham didn't require complex passwords for systems that managed consumers' payment card information. Wyndham stored credit card numbers in clear, readable texts, making it much more available to hackers.
Wyndham declined to provide a comment on the air because the case is still in active litigation. In a statement, the company said that Congress has not provided the FTC with a broad authority to pursue such cases against American businesses. The FTC's Jessica Rich disagrees.
We have authority to bring action against companies that engage in either deceptive or unfair practices. Deceptive practices means that companies have made misstatements about the level of security they provide, or unfairness basically means putting consumers at unreasonable risk of injury.
To protect the consumer, the FTC wants companies to take strong measures to prevent personal data from falling into the wrong hands.
There have been so many breaches of data in recent years. Identity theft has really been on the rise. It's a high priority at the Federal Trade Commission to promote better data security, including by bringing action against companies that fail to do so.
When the FTC finds a company has failed to sufficiently protect consumers, it levies penalties. Companies are required to implement a data security program, often for up to 20 years. Companies must report to the FTC, and there are third-party audit requirements. In some cases, civil penalties also apply. Again, Jessica Rich.
And that's a very powerful tool to make sure that the company implements data security in the future.
For their part, Wyndham Worldwide says they did have substantial security measures in place. Their statement to NPR goes on to say, quote, "To our knowledge, the cybercriminals responsible for the attacks have never been apprehended by law enforcement officials." Woodrow Hartzog is a professor focusing on privacy issues at the Samford University Law School.
A popular argument is that the FTC is punishing the victim here. They are punishing the person who was victimized by a burglar in their own house.
Hartzog doesn't buy that argument.
I think the much better analogy is that the FTC is punishing companies like Wyndham for leaving their door unlocked, but it was someone else's stuff that was inside the house.
Jessica Rich says the FTC does acknowledge the wrongdoing of the hackers.
But any company that collects sensitive information from consumers and fails to protect it is also at fault. And so to stop these types of breaches, we believe it's also appropriate to hold the company accountable.
But who should hold the companies accountable is not clear. Congress has never officially passed a broad data security policy. Without the FTC in a de facto role, it starts to look a little like there's no sheriff in town. Again, Professor Hartzog.
If you have health information, if you have financial information, you have to provide a certain amount of data security. But for the most part, this is largely an unregulated area. We've made the decision years ago to try to approach privacy in a fragmented kind of way. Inevitably, what that means is that things fall through the cracks.
When the internet was first adopted, people realized that personal information would be out there, but there was no clear way to regulate it. So companies started coming up with those wonderful disclaimers you have to click on. Here's a dramatic reading.
Our privacy commitments are fundamental to the way we do business.
When you register an account, we collect some personal information, such as your name.
We use information collected from cookies and other technologies, like pixel tags, to improve your user.
This may include network and communication information, such as your IP address or mobile phone.
We will notify you of any revisions to our privacy policy in advance. No surprises.
Be honest. Do you read those all the way through? Neither do I. Ilana Westerman is the CEO of Create with Context. They conduct research on privacy issues from the user perspective. In a study last year, participants downloaded an app that required them to agree to privacy terms before using it.
And then we asked them what it said, and 98% of people hadn't read it. And the reason was because they weren't ready to read it. The timing wasn't right.
Most people just wanted to explore the app, not read an essay.
As humans, we're just kind of going along, doing what we're doing with our digital devices, and we're not sitting there analyzing what is being collected. We're not going out and investigating it.
But if you skip or skim these agreements, you might be giving up personal information without realizing it. One notorious example that got a lot of attention in the press. When Jay-Z's new album was released in July, Samsung Galaxy phone users had the option to get it for free. What some didn't realize, most likely because they didn't read the agreement, is that the app requested information, including physical location and phone activity data. Ilana Westerman says it's a new world for everyone.
For designers, for developers, for companies, for consumers. And so I think as people who are creating this, these types of products and services for consumers, it's just our job to, as much as possible, try to create that transparency for them.
But as to whose job it is to police that transparency, until the Wyndham case, the FTC had been doing that unchallenged. All cases before this one have ended in settlements. It's usually less expensive to just settle and follow the FTC guidelines. So I asked Professor Hartzog, for all of us out there going through the motions and ignoring privacy policies, are we being dumb?
No. One thing that almost everybody knows about privacy policies is that nobody reads them. In fact, these things are very rarely enforced as contracts. So I think the FTC has come to recognize that it's relatively insane to ask consumers to read and understand all of these agreements. And so they're going to act accordingly.
Meanwhile, Wyndham Hotel's case against the Federal Trade Commission drags on in the New Jersey federal court. Oral arguments concluded in early November. In recent years, several data security bills have been proposed in Congress, but all have languished thus far. If the Federal Trade Commission loses to Wyndham, the question of who protects the internet consumer will be getting a lot more attention. Freedom of the press is considered an essential ideal of American democracy. President Obama acknowledged as much last month when he draped a Presidential Medal of Freedom around the neck of former Washington Post executive editor Ben Bradley.
With Ben in charge, the Post published the Pentagon Papers, revealing the true history of America's involvement in Vietnam, exposed Watergate, unleashed a new era of investigative journalism, holding America's leaders accountable and reminding us that Our freedom as a nation rests on our freedom of the press.
Today's investigative journalists may not be feeling the love. I asked New York Times reporter James Risen, in terms of openness or transparency attitudes towards the press, how would you rank the Obama administration?
I think it's the worst. I think it's worse than the Bush administration, which I never thought I would say.
Risen has found himself at the center of a modern fight over what freedom of the press means. And that's our cover story today. Just how much does the First Amendment shield reporters from the law? James Risen is most famous for revealing the NSA's wiretapping program in 2005. The next year, his book State of War was released. It contained a chapter about a bungled CIA operation, an effort to sabotage the Iranian nuclear program by supplying them with faulty blueprints failed when a sketchy middleman revealed the flaws to the Iranians. A dramatic and embarrassing story, one that would never have been told had it not been for Risen's unnamed source. The Bush administration investigated a former CIA officer named Jeffrey Sterling, and in 2008, Risen was subpoenaed to testify against him. Risen refused with a classic argument. He had a First Amendment right, as a reporter, to protect his source. The incoming Obama administration not only continued to pursue the subpoena, they doubled down on their efforts to compel James Risen to testify.
They've taken the whole legal approach on this issue to a new level. The Bush administration, you know, really talked a lot about these issues, but the Obama people have actually done, you know, a lot more aggressive investigations and prosecutions, and I think they've made things much worse.
Have they been invasive in terms of trying to find out information about your reporting and your sources?
Yeah, I mean, they have. It's come out in the case that they got access to a number of travel records, credit card records, credit reports. And I know that witnesses who had to testify before the grand jury have subsequently told me that prosecutors showed them copies of phone logs of calls between the two of us. It's never been clear to me how they were getting those phone logs.
Judith Miller, a former colleague of yours from the New York Times, when she was willing to brave jail to protect a source, it got a ton of attention. Even before she actually went to prison, and I've had to search for details about your case. What do you make of if you agree that there's a lack of attention this time around?
Maybe we're all getting used to a new era of tighter security and, you know, the post 9/11 world, perhaps. I don't know the answer to that. That's a good question, but I don't think there's a big public constituency for the press. People don't really care about our problems too much, which I can't blame them about, really.
Can you explain to people, I mean, especially people that aren't journalists and aren't part of this world, why this is worth going to jail over for you?
This is about the First Amendment. It's really no longer just a specific case. One of the things that surprised me about the way the government has approached this case was the Obama administration in their appeal laid out a very basic, fundamental, and constitutional issue. They don't believe there is any reporter's privilege in a criminal case. And the fact that the Fourth Circuit three-judge panel essentially accepted that view makes this a very fundamental constitutional issue. Does the First Amendment provide sufficient protection under the law to journalists to do their job? Because if there is no such thing as a reporter's privilege, then confidential sources in American journalism will all be at risk. Oversight, accountability, journalism throughout the United States will be at risk. And so I think this is a very fundamental issue that I'm willing to fight for.
That's New York Times reporter James Risen.
Well, I respect Mr. Risen's convictions, but essentially he's engaging in an act of civil disobedience.
Rodney Smola is a First Amendment scholar and a visiting professor at the Duke University School of Law.
Although First Amendment values are enormously important to our society, there are other values that are also important. And one of the most fundamental notions in a system that believes in the rule of law is that courts are entitled to every person's evidence. When a journalist accepts material from someone who the journalist knows is breaking the law and handing the journalist that material, The journalist is on the one hand engaged in the altruistic and important function of news gathering, but he or she is also watching a crime in progress. And the traditional notion in this country is that no one is above the law. And even though we have many situations in which we protect confidentiality, at times that must give way. And so, as much as I respect Mr. Risen's integrity in wanting to protect his source, the fact remains that there's a very strong argument, and I think it was established in 1972, that there is no First Amendment rule that protects a journalist from being forced to testify when he or she has evidence of a crime.
In the 1972 case Smola referred to, Brandsburg v. Hayes, the Supreme Court ruled a reporter did not have a right to refuse a subpoena in a criminal case. Over the years, media lawyers have found enough gray area in one justice's opinion to argue that in some cases, reporters could refuse. But today the consensus is no. Reporters like James Risen do not have a First Amendment right to protect their sources, not at the federal level at least.
Now, ironically, if he were involved in a state court tussle with the government, there would be a much greater probability that he could protect a confidential source.
Lucy Dalglish is the dean of the journalism school at the University of Maryland. She says that while a majority of states have some kind of law to shield reporters, there's nothing at the federal level.
We've been battling for years trying to get Congress to pass a shield law, and so far we've not been successful.
But Dalglish says federal subpoenas for reporters have actually declined recently, but not for reasons investigative reporters would celebrate.
I've had people in the government tell me they can grab your credit cards, they can monitor your phones. You know, this is one of the last subpoenas you're ever going to see because we don't need you people anymore. We know who you're talking to.
The Department of Justice, in a statement to NPR, said they believe, quote, that leaks of classified information damage our national security and must be investigated using appropriate law enforcement tools. But that they are, quote, committed to making sure we strike the right balance in protecting the First Amendment and protecting information vital to our national security. As for James Risen, his lawyers say they plan to file with the Supreme Court next month. If that fails, he says he'll go to jail rather than reveal his sources. If you're just joining us, it's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. The Winter Olympics are right around the corner. Thanks in part to the influence of the X Games, skiing is more exciting and popular than ever. But there's an intense competition over skiing that won't be settled at the Olympics. Several countries contend for the title of the birthplace of skiing. Norway, Sweden, Finland, and Russia have all staked claims. Now China has thrown its hat into the ring. Travel writer Mark Jenkins went there.
The claims of the Chinese most recently from this research and this trip I did were that they invented skis almost 10,000 years ago. The archaeology on it is somewhat questionable, but the Russians do have an archaeological site that has found a ski tip that is 8,000 years old. And in fact, skis turn out to be older than the wheel, so they're one of the very first forms of transportation.
And wherever it started, it's hard, I think, today to find people who still ski in a way which might be the ancient style, but you did. So can you tell us about the Altais in western China?
Yeah, this is western China. In fact, it's very far northwestern China. We were within a stone's throw, literally 10 miles, of Kazakhstan, Mongolia, and Siberia. And the Altai Mountains are a range that go up to about 15,000 feet, kind of dead center Central Asia. These are Tuvan people who come from Siberia, and they've been skiing for at least 4,000 years. And their skis are remarkable. They cut them from red spruce. They bend them by heating them and steaming them, and then they nail on horsehair on the bottom of the skis, which is very slick to glide forward, but then grabs when you go uphill.
And these men, like the ancient skiers you were talking about, they're skiing to hunt.
That's right. This is what it's all about. It's really about hunting. And I've done lots of long, hard expeditions, and this was one of the most fascinating because these guys are so inured to the cold, first of all. I asked them if they ever had frostbite, and they didn't even know what the term was.
And cold, you're talking 40 below zero, right?
Yeah, 40 below zero, yeah. And what they do is they ski out in single file. They're pulling goat hair sleds, and they find elk tracks, which aren't hard to find because now the elk are so heavy. They're sinking into the snow. They will hunt track elk for 3 to 7 days on their skis.
And then once they finally find the elk, how do they chase them down?
This is the most remarkable part. They're using a technique that's several thousand years old. They have lassos, and they ski downhill, screaming, wild, and with a lasso, just like a cowboy, but they're on skis. And they ski downhill, and they loop the lasso. It's a very big loop because it has to go over the antlers of the elk and then lasso the elk. The elk is bucking and kicking and snorting, and they fall sideways, perpendicular to the, and so they're basically, they're like an anchor, old man in the sea sort of thing. They're being pulled by this elk through the snow. Of course, the elk is so deep in the snow, it's practically swimming. So within an hour or two, the elk has worn itself out.
Wow. But in this case, they captured two elk and let them go, right?
They did, yeah. They just waited till the elk were exhausted and couldn't barely lift their heads, and then walked over to them, took the lassos off their antlers, and waited for them to recover, and they eventually kind of just, to their great fortune, just wandered back into the woods.
This was a weird detail. You actually found out what happened with those two elk.
Right. There are still wolves in this region, and the wolves ate these two elk about 2 weeks later. There's a funny story about the kind of a gruesome story about the wolves, because they are quite concerned about wolves. I was going to go for a long midnight ski tour one time solo, and they just wouldn't allow me to do it. And I said, well, why not? This is a common thing to do in my home state of Wyoming. And they said, oh, you'll get attacked by wolves. And I kind of laughed it off. And then they told me the story of a guy who was on a motorcycle who got stuck. His motorcycle died, and he got surrounded by a wolf pack. I don't know if I believe the story. It might be apocryphal. But he called the police, and the police said, we'll be there as soon as we can. In the meantime, light your motorcycle on fire. And he did that, and by the time the police arrived, they found a burnt motorcycle and a head inside a helmet. And that's all.
And that's Mark Jenkins talking about a wild trip he took to report on the history of skiing for National Geographic. His article appears in this month's issue of the magazine. Check out the photos online at npr.org. Imagine flying around the world, round trip, in a span of days, for the purpose of earning frequent flyer miles. That's the idea behind mileage runs, spending hours in an airplane to gain status on an airline. As NPR's Daniel Hajek reports, it's no vacation.
So, front pocket, I grab my Kindle, headphones, phone charger.
Travis MacRitchie is packing a single carry-on bag for a flight halfway across the world.
I'm going off on a pretty ridiculous adventure, so fingers crossed it'll go okay.
He's headed to the Middle East on a flight to Bahrain. And here's why this adventure is so ridiculous. He'll be back home in 3 days.
All right, here we go.
MacRitchie is embarking on his first mileage run. L.A. to Washington, D.C., D.C. to Dubai, and Dubai to Bahrain. This 3-day round-trip flight he planned will earn him 36,000 frequent flyer miles, guaranteeing him gold status with United Airlines.
The perks definitely make travel much, much easier.
Priority security screening, complimentary upgrades, and airport lounge access. For MacRitchie, being pent up in a plane is worth it.
I enjoy the process of traveling itself. To me, it's fun. So I could definitely think of worse things to be doing on my weekend.
This may sound expensive, but his ticket is just $600. His boarding pass prints out, and MacRitchie is on his way.
It really is about getting a deal.
Howard Rappaport is an editor for the Frugal Travel Guy blog. He says mileage runners scour the web and post on forums like FlyerTalk.com for specials, discounted prices, and mistake fares.
Looking in one of the forums there, someone had posted a deal that American Airlines had a fare from Philadelphia to Beijing, China for just under $450, and that would be round trip.
Rappaport already bought his ticket. And never mind the destination. He says mileage running is all about gaining status.
When it comes to loyalty, you can kind of get caught into a trap. It's almost like a drug, because when you start getting those benefits, you don't want to lose those benefits.
3 days later, Travis MacRitchie returns from his marathon flight. He walks out of LAX with messy hair and a scruffy beard. He looks exhausted.
Oh, man. Well, it was successful in the fact that I got back here okay, and I'm still awake, so, yeah, I made it.
He spent over 40 hours in the air. He was actually in Bahrain for just half a day.
Walked around Bahrain for a little bit, ate some shawarma, and that's about all I did.
He says the trip back felt like an eternity.
That plane would not get there. I felt like we were going in reverse.
Still, MacRitchie says he would do it again if the price is right, but those days may be numbered. Starting in January, United and Delta will incorporate spending requirements in addition to miles. If you want to maintain the top premier status on United, you'll have to accrue 100,000 miles and spend $10,000 for those flights. Ariana Argandawal, managing editor at FlyerTalk.com, says that defeats the whole purpose of mileage runs.
Mileage running is going to be a dying sport in the future because very few mileage runners are going to see any value in spending, you know, $10,000 just to get upgrades and a certain number of miles and bonuses on their flights each year.
But miles earned this year will still get you status next year. And there's still 2.5 weeks left before 2014. That's plenty of time to fit in some quick last-minute trips around the world. Just sit back, relax, and try to enjoy the flight. Daniel Hajek, NPR News.
Omid Jalili is a British actor and comedian of Iranian descent. American audiences may know him from his role as a sidekick on the short-lived TV show Whoopi, or from his small parts in major Hollywood movies like The Mummy and Gladiator.
I actually became a kind of Arab scumbag specialist.
But just as he was starting to really make a name for himself here, complete with a half-hour special on HBO, he went back to Britain. He's just recently returned for a few shows in the U.S. before embarking on his U.K. tour in the spring. I asked him about his unusual path.
I've always been uncomfortable making it in a different country before you've made it in your own country. Those of us who were given those half hours, it was myself, Louis C.K., and there were a lot of very, very good people, Caroline Ray. Their all careers went on and did great, but I went back to Britain because I had my own TV show there. They gave me something called The Omid Jalili Show, and that kind of preoccupied me.
I wonder if you could describe the show a little bit, because you play Iranian characters and British characters. It's kind of a whole, it's a wide range.
You can't really compare that kind of thing with any show, but I think the nearest show you might have had here was the Dave Chappelle show, which was on Comedy Central, which was stand-up, sketches, little items here and there. My English side really loves the royal family, and my Iranian side hates me for this. It does, and my Iranian side always chips in if I ever meet royalty. I met Prince Charles recently. I said, Your Royal Highness, it's a real absolute honour to perform for you. You dirty, filthy Western imperialist!
Something interesting about the success of your program is that a similar thing happened, I think it was probably about 10 years ago in Britain. More like 15 years ago. There was a British BBC program called Goodness Gracious Me.
Yes, I know
which
those
was
guys.
Indians.
Yes.
And I thought at the time, well, there's no way that this will hit a wider audience because they're making fun of very specific things about Indians that only Indians will get. And it was a huge success.
Huge success,
and
yes.
Similarly with your program, you're making fun of, I think, very particular Iranian characters at times. But
yes.
It resonates with people.
I think there was a niche in the market because, you know, the more multicultural we become, and it's certainly in British culture, as I'm sure it is the same with American culture, we warm to cultures where people can make fun of themselves.
I couldn't abide by all my Iranian brethren suddenly saying, we're from Persia. No, we're not Iranian, we're from Persia. So that makes a big difference. And people say, oh, you're from Persia. Oh, you mean next to Assyria, Mesopotamia, and Thrace. What a noble race of people. Oh, it's a bit like a Persian cat. Yes, a sweet Persian cat. Yeah. No, not an Iranian cat. No, Iranian cat has a bomb under the body warmer.
With what had happened with awful things with terrorism, there was a lot of mistrust. So there was a lot of, I suppose, reciprocity towards a Middle Eastern person who can maybe be a bridge between East and West. You can tell I'm a very, very British person. But I've kept my roots quite strong. I still speak Farsi. I find Arabs hilarious. Like, whenever you go on YouTube and watch some of the greatest soccer players, like Lionel Messi scoring a goal, the Arab commentaries, they say, Yawalat, Yawalat, Sahib al Hulul, fi kulli zamin, fi kulli makan, fatahadas, fatahadas a Messi, huwa the Messi! And the translation is that Messi is the stealer of hearts. He is the creator of solutions. Messi has the eye of the griffin. If Messi was a pre-existent soul made manifest in this life as the return of the Jesus Christ in the football boots, I tell you, if Messi was gay, I look the other way. Oh, what a Messi! They're very passionate.
All of a sudden, American sportcasters seem very, very bland. I'm amazed you could do that. I'm curious, you mentioned Dave Chappelle, yes. And you know how he left his program, walked away from it. And I'm wondering if you've felt the same feeling that caused him to walk away, which is that, I mean, you do these Iranian characters, and it's on a show in Britain. And Dave Chappelle got uncomfortable because he was doing these black characters, and he felt the white audience was laughing a little bit too hard, and maybe at the expense.
Yeah, that's always a consideration. It's a very, very thin line. I don't just worry about, you know, upsetting the Iranians. I also worry about the Baha'i community. I'm a Baha'i. I'm not a Muslim. I'm a Baha'i. And the Baha'i faith is such a sweet faith. You know, the Baha'is are so sweet that even hippies in San Francisco mug the Baha'is regularly. You know, that's how sweet they are. But I've got to be careful not to upset my Baha'i friends as well. So it is, there's a high pressure. But for you, you need to have certain principles. And for me, it's always to remain authentic. Remain true to my own comedy voice, and if you do that, then you'll be fine.
Has there been any kind of a negative reaction, though, from the Iranian community in Britain or elsewhere?
I suppose Iranians have pushed me of being some kind of acceptable face, because even when 9/11 happened, even my own neighbors, and they knew me and they liked me, they started looking at me suspiciously. I didn't go anywhere. A lot of my gigs were canceled, and I actually thought my career was over.
Wow.
It was very strange, and I just won an award, the Time Out Magazine Comedy Award. And what they do, they put you up in a big West End theater, and everybody was going nuts. People were giving their tickets back, and I felt I had to make a stand. I said, I'm making a stand here. You know, I know that a lot of Indian guys have been beaten, some Sikh guys have been killed, so I'm going to make a stand to do a comedy show here for you tonight. And there was a big round of applause, and I said, I want you all to know my real name is Sven. I'm from Gothenburg in Sweden. I got nothing to do with those creeps. So that was, and the laugh, I remember, it's a very basic joke, but just the laugh of relief was extraordinary. And then I thought, okay, we're back on track. It's too soon to laugh too much, but we can try and make sense of it through comedy. And I'm not saying you can ever make fun of suffering. That's completely wrong. But I think now we're ready to have, we have Middle Eastern comedians now, and they're very much embraced by the American community. And I hope that what we say has some depth and has some value.
Omar Jalili, pleasure talking with you.
Thank you very much. It's been really good. I really hope that people embrace me into the bosom of America.
It's time now for the new and the next. Carlos Watson is the co-founder of the online magazine Aussie. Each week he joins us to talk about what's new and what's next. Welcome back, Carlos.
Arun, always good to be with you.
So I want to start off with my favorite story. I love tales of brilliance from unexpected corners. And physicist Hakim Alashehi, he definitely fits the bill. I can't think of another gangsta scientist.
I mean, what a fantastic story. Now, today, those who love the Discovery Channel or increasingly National Geographic will enjoy his television shows. But little will they know that before he was a Stanford PhD astrophysicist, Hakim Alashehi was a college dropout. Always loved physics from the time he was in the fifth grade. In fact, made his way to college, but didn't do well. Dropped out and pursued much more of a gangster lifestyle, and ultimately doubled back, got his degree, and made his way through a very rigorous program at Stanford, and today is one of the increasingly popular public scientists.
And what's wild as well about it, the trajectory, is he's made it big. He's got all these patents. He was working in the commercial world, but he decided to give that up.
He did. So he was working at one of the big firms, Applied Materials, for a number of years after his PhD, but ultimately decided his heart wasn't in it. And so said, I want to go back to academia and research and study. And in particular, spends a lot of time looking at space exploration.
So we have a gangster college dropout who becomes a scientist. It makes kind of a nice pairing with another peculiar trajectory. That's J.R. Hildebrand. This kid, he's on a path to maybe becoming a scientist himself. He's at MIT, but decides he wants to be a race car driver.
Holy cow. So J.R. Hildebrand started racing go-karts at the age of 14, realized he actually was pretty good at it, maybe even better than he was at baseball. But better than either of those two things was his aptitude for math and science. And Arun, he was so good that he got an acceptance from MIT. And ultimately, he said no so that he could go out and try and become the next Dale Earnhardt or Jeff Gordon.
He gets this natural relationship between physics and racing, but he wants to help other kids understand science using that as a bridge.
He thinks that, you know, for so many people who don't relate to math and science, what better real-life example is there than kind of fast cars and big-time races? As much as he wants to win the Indy 500, what he really wants to do is make math and science sexy again.
So switching gears, sorry about that, but something that's always bugged me. I love modern art, but it always seems that exhibits of modern art and even discussions about it, they all draw from the developed world. It's Europe and the Americas. But it sounds like things are changing.
Things seem to be changing indeed. I mean, look no further than the very famous Tate Museum in London. And one of their big exhibitions recently had to do with African art. But it wasn't the same kinds of African art that we used to think about, meaning the tribal mask and some of the other things. Instead, these works of art coming from Ghana and Benin and Kenya and other places had as much to do with race, with class, with aspiration. Arun, I think this is part of a broader rediscovery, if you will, of Africa.
Do you think it's problematic at all that, you know, this is high art, it's being consumed, you know, by elites? Does that do good for Africa on the whole?
I think so. And to the extent that the artists in various parts of Africa have the opportunity to be supported and flourish, and in fact that younger emerging artists can see that there's a career path forward, I think that's incredibly important. Now, I think one of the real important questions, though, will we start to see as many interesting galleries and museums on the African continent, and will those be available to students and to families and to everyday people so that they can enjoy it as well?
Carlos Watson is the co-founder of the online magazine Ozzy. You can explore all the stories we talk about at npr.org/new and next. Carlos, thanks again.
Arun, always good to be with you. Look forward to seeing you next week.
Once again, this is All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. I'd like you to sit back now and let us take you through a detective story, a weird kind of musical mystery. It starts with a record label trying to compile the work of a 70s and 80s Nigerian funk legend.
I was going to call the record, This is William Onyebar, up until the point we realized we didn't know anything about him, and then we changed the title to Who is William Onyebar?
That's Yale Evelev. He runs Luwaka Bob, a pretty famous name in world music. Evelev digs up information about great forgotten musicians for a living, and even he couldn't find out much about this William Onyebar guy. To this day, we're not even sure exactly how to pronounce his name. When I play my kind of music, I'm playing for your body and soul. When I sing my kind of song, I'm singing for your body and soul. William Onyebar put out 8 albums of some pretty amazing synth funk. It's fun, layered, and madly imaginative, kind of like a Nigerian George Clinton. But he halted recording in the mid-80s and converted to Christianity. Since then, if you mention his life and music around him, he stops the conversation dead. Naturally, rumors rushed in to fill the vacuum. Onyebar had gone on to run a flour mill. He went to film school in Soviet Russia. He went to study law in London. Maybe a combination of these things. William Onyebar's legend grew and grew. Yale Evelev called William Onyebar himself and tried to get him to confirm any of this.
And he said to me,
why would I want to talk about that? I just want to talk about Jesus.
And then he hung up the phone.
Most artists are thrilled when the Luwaka Bob comes calling. For Yale Evelev, this went beyond eccentricity. William Onyebar became a nightmare. But let's go back to the beginning. The idea for this compilation was brought to Luwaka Bob by an expert in Nigerian music.
My name is Uchenna Ikone. I'm a writer and a DJ and sometime record producer.
And Yale Evelev says Ikone told him,
hey, you did this compilation of psychedelic African records, and one of the tracks was with William Onyebar. Would you like to do a whole record of him?
I originally had planned to put the project out myself, but then I decided that it was bigger than I could handle at the time.
I said, I would love to. That would be great. Uchenna says, great, because I'm from Enugu in Nigeria, and he's from Enugu, and I'm going to go back home for Christmas. And I thought, thank God, a straightforward, easy compilation to do.
From there, the issue was to get the rights. And I said I would be able to do that, as I had already made contact with Mr. Onyebar.
And if you give me a contract and some advance money, I'll give it to him. I'm signing the contract, and you can do a compilation.
And I'd be back in a month. And somehow, I ended up staying there for over 9 months. And I came back without the deal. We'll be right back.
Lucena comes back to where he lives in Boston and says, I'm kind of embarrassed, but I gave him the advance money because he was going to go to the bank that day. Then I was supposed to go back the next day to sign the contract, but the next day never happened. So he has the money, but I don't have the contract.
3 years would pass before William Onyebor would sign on the dotted line. But what happened during Uchenna Ikone's 9 months in Nigeria? That's a story in and of itself. Ikone knew he was in for a bumpy ride. He'd heard the rumors of Onyebor's legendary temper.
He's very difficult.
Wicked.
Prickly.
Unpredictable.
He is evil.
Evil.
Yeah. Ikone traveled to Enugu, way outside town, on dirt roads, to his rural, isolated home.
He lives in a palace. He always makes reference to his palace. He doesn't say home. You know, the average person might say, you know, I'm tired, I think I want to go home. He would say, I'm tired, I need to go back to my palace.
And when you were interacting with him, is he a nice guy? How was he?
When I met him, I found him to be a fairly nice guy. You know, he's funny, he can be very warm, but he can turn. When he turns, he's hard. I mean, I came away when after the period that I had gone through my ordeal with him, for about 2 years after that, if you had asked me this question, I would have said he is evil. But I've had time to reflect upon it. And, you know, I remember some of the happier times that we've shared. But when he turns, he really turns.
And what's that like? Why would you use the word evil in the past?
He was really hard on me. we things got bad between us. Things got extremely bitter. And I felt that he acted in some ways that I felt were really duplicitous in a way.
He was misleading with you?
Yeah, sometimes. What happened was somehow I gave him the money and he didn't sign the contract. And when I asked him for the money, he said, if I give you back the money, the deal's over. Well, let's put it this way. I gave him the money, which he felt was only part of the money. So he didn't sign the deal because he said he wants the rest of the money.
He was considering it basically an advance on a good faith advance.
Yeah, I would say that.
I don't know if you can go into any detail. It just sounds a lot more intense than a typical negotiation. It just sounds, the way you're talking, it sounds like it was emotionally draining for you.
It was. Oh, yeah. Not just emotionally draining. It was emotionally devastating. I felt that this man completely crushed my soul. I mean, after I finished dealing with him, I didn't listen to his music for maybe 2 years. Because just hearing his voice would almost give me an anxiety attack. I mean, I did talk to him on the phone a few times, you know, for over the years after that. But believe me, before I talked to him on the phone, I would have to psych myself up.
What was he doing, though? What was
Some of it I can't talk about, but, you know, at one point he decided that I was an agent of Satan.
Wow.
Yeah, that had been sent to cause confusion in his life, and he would smite me.
Wow. That's not something I imagine you've heard from most of the artists you've worked with.
No, not at all.
Well, you've done these amazing compilations. You've worked with the artists bringing out some of this Nigerian funk, and I'm sure a lot of people who have not accused you of being agent of the devil. Was it worth it?
Was it worth it? It's worth it in that I was able to deliver the executed contract to Loakabop. That was important to me. I'm a man who keeps his word. And I knew they're probably thinking at some point, hey, okay, so some Nigerian guy calls us up and says, send me some money so I can get you this contract. And we just sent it to him, you know? So... it was important to me to deliver, to prove that I was not some guy who writes emails claiming to be the son of a king, you know, that whole deal.
That's Uchenna Ikone, an expert in Nigerian music. Together, he and Yael Evilev at Loakabop have, at long last, released the very first legitimate compilation of this music. It's called Who is William Onyebar? A question Avilev never got him to answer.
He said to me, Yale, you can sell my music, but don't sell me.
William Onyebar declined to be interviewed for this story. For the week ending December 14th, 2013, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. Our production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, and Daniel Hajek. Our intern is Francesca Fenzi. The technical director is Patrick Murray, with technical support from Leah Dogups. I was going to screw up your name, man. With technical support from Leah Delagula. Leo, say it for me, Leo. Leo Delagula. And Marcia Caldwell. Muthoni Muturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.